So hello everyone. So I guess I will be talking about some things that have already been repeated a few times through a week, but I'll try to say some new things as well. So this is something I don't need to tell you. So we have this 2.5 black hole, some people say 2.85. And the guy I like is this one. So two very massive black holes, consistent to an equal mass ratio. And varying certain considerations, we can say that this is something chemically homogeneous evolution can do. Now we got this other guy. This is the one I don't quite like. This is for the other groups. And this is what chemically homogeneous evolution, unless push to the extremes, cannot do. And I will briefly get into that as well. We have, these are the other two options. We have the field formation involving common envelope, and we have the dynamic formation channels. And in terms of forming stuff, forming these observed black holes, we can say these guys can do it as well. So to go into a bit more detail into the chemically homogeneous evolution channel. So it was André Méder in the 87 that essentially proposed that rotation can produce a bifurcation in the evolution of stars. And the idea is that if you have slowly rotating stars, they behave as the usual textbook massive star. They become redder through the main sequence. They deplete hydrogen and then just become red giants all the way down there. If you have strong rotation, this can induce large-scale mixing. And instead of going redwards, you just become helium-rich throughout your whole star, and it becomes compact. Until eventually, you deplete hydrogen, and instead of going all the way down there, this star goes all the way down there. So some important physical aspects to take into consideration here is that this is a process, so this for a given rotation, these currents, we would expect them to be stronger in more massive stars. And the reason for this is that we need to fight against stratification in a radiative envelope. And for more massive stars, you have stronger radiation pressure, which essentially helps reduce the strength of the stratification. As Stan was telling about having these very massive stars, large winds, large spin down, that's an issue here. The thing is that if you have high metallicity, you would have strong winds. And this essentially slows down your star and can break down this process. So you can be evolving chemically homogeneous, but at some point you slow down too much and you go back to sort of normal evolution. And the last point, which is not least, is that for this to work, you need to have stars that are rapidly rotating from birth. And we don't know if this is quite the case. That depends on some things. I know you have some models on that, but I think that maybe we could talk about that afterwards.
Yeah, certainly my model.
Yeah. No, yeah, but I know you do that as well. One thing we were discussing before is essentially what fudges we add when we talk about this this chemically homogeneous channel. And the fudge we add is essentially an extra factor that parameterizes the mixing efficiency. So the thing is that we have some simple theoretical models that gives us sets of mixing coefficients for different rotational processes. And to consider possible uncertainties in here, we have a fudge factor on the front. So we can observe populations of stars. We have some surveys of massive stars. This is a survey on B stars, the flame survey. And one thing they observed is that, if you see how the rotational velocity of the stars correlates with nitrogen enhancement, sort of you get something that's all over the place if you see it. But some people sort of say that, you have some certain measurements that go along diagonal in here. There are two different, these are LMC stars. So the main idea here is that if you check nitrogen enhancement, nitrogen is a good probe of mixing deep material that's deep into the star, because it's a probe of material that has gone through CNO burning. So if you have CNO burning, it's quite easy to turn all your carbon into nitrogen, and that allows you to produce a boost in this direction if you manage to put that material on the top of the star. And the thing is that we can play a bit with this fudges for mixing, and we get some variations on how stars would behave. So these are theoretical tracks for a 13 solar mass star. And the thing is that we don't have infinite freedom in the way we play with this, because otherwise we would have the theoretical tracks going way up, which is something we don't see. And in particular, we can check, we can run several models for given initial masses and rotational velocities, and we can check both the what happens with nitrogen in these stars at the end of their lifetimes, how much they enrich through the main sequence, but also how much they enrich in terms of helium. And the thing is that if we push high enough in mass and high enough in initial rotation, we run to a point where it's not just nitrogen we're getting, we're also getting helium. So these are the guys we want to get for this chemically homogeneous evolution. If we start getting helium rich, then we form a more compact star, and we have this the possibility of this channel. And one thing you may notice as well is that here you have a big drop as you go to higher masses, and this is because at some point mass loss starts helping. Mass loss as well helps you go deeper and deeper through the star and reach layers that were processed before. So, well, here you have the chemically homogeneous evolution channel. This is the cartoon from Selma and Ilya's paper. And the main idea is that this same bifurcation you have from in terms of rotational velocity, it can be translated into a bifurcation in terms of initial orbital period, assuming tidal locking. So if you have a short orbital period, you get rapid rotational velocities and chemically homogeneous evolution go up, and you just have standard evolution with Roach lobe overflow. And the thing is that if both stars in a binary are going through this channel, then you can form two black holes. If it's compact enough, they can merge in a reasonable amount of time. Now, we don't have, it's nice essentially to, it would be nice to have observational counterparts of different points of this evolution. And I guess an important one would be to be probing this phase. So when the mixing has occurred and we get these very, very high mass helium stars. And there is one interesting object, this system parameters were estimated by Gloria Königsberger. And the thing is that we have two very hydrogen poor stars with masses over 60 solar masses, and a relatively short orbital period. And well, the thing is that this, if we expect these stars to be the product of this kind of evolution, what I want to mean is that it's very hard to get these masses and this kind of separations from the common envelope evolution channel. This is something that's very hard to make. And in a way, well, this is already too wide. Even if it would be forming black holes, it's too wide to merge. But it's a proof that at least this phase, which is the least uncertain, these mixing processes can work.
Is it close enough that tides force you to be in chemically homogeneous evolution?
It's not close enough, but it could have been close enough before. So you should expect strong mass loss from this star, so it should widen the orbit. So actually, I have some models that end up with these masses and started being much more compact. So in terms of how hard it is to make this in terms of common envelope evolution, I think we can look at this. Just wanted to mention that for this, there's a very finite amount of literature, so which sort of makes it nice to round it up. But going a bit back to this SMC star, I think one thing that's interesting about it is that it's a bit more exotic than just those three numbers, masses and periods. To begin with, the binary has a measured eccentricity. So this is a bit, we wouldn't expect to have eccentricity from chemically homogeneous evolution. But the other interesting thing is that there's a third light component that is in a, that appears to be in its own binary. So we would have a hierarchical binary. This is in a longer period with a much larger eccentricity. And the interesting thing, if we see these two systems as a hierarchical binary, is that they seem to have a resonance going on. So the orbital period of the system we care about is about five times less than of this third light component, and very close to this precise five, which would give the impression that this is overall an interacting system, and that could possibly explain this eccentricity going on. And the thing is that having another star in here in all the systems makes it even harder for this to be to evolve through common envelope, because it would be hard to have these 3,000 solar radius stars with a third component in close enough to be interacting like this. No, but this is not, it's not a triple. It would be a quadruple essentially.
Oh, I see. That's
so we're missing a component in here. So well, if we want fast rotation, a possibility to do this is to go as close and as close as possible, and at one point we actually get contact binaries. So this is the most massive example we know from the BLT Flames Tarantula survey. There are two stars of almost the same mass. The mass ratio is very close to one. And it has a period of about 1 day. And we have some hints that this might be helium-enriched. It's not direct helium measurements, but rather the sizes of the star would appear to show that there's helium enrichment going on. And the thing is that they look more compact than they should, which is an indication of mixing as well. So what we would like to have. So, well, putting this possibility of contact together with this possibility of chemically homogeneous evolution in a binary, we can as well add the possibility of, we can just put them together and start with two stars that are in contact and will form black holes. And the main thing about this contact phase is that, well, what we expect from modeling this phase is that we get almost the same masses for both components. And as well, we have plenty of angular momentum, so when the stars finish their lifetimes, they can do exotic stuff. And eventually, you end up with your binary that was always in a very compact orbit. And well, as usual with most things, you have mega-year timescale evolution here, giga-year timescale evolution to the merger.
So,
it would be hard to get it that way, I think. The GRBs are a subset of the possibilities, I think.
Are a subset?
Yes.
So that means that your statement was not true?
Yeah, he would not be left.
You would not be left.
Oh.
If it's only
yes.
A subset, then
yes.
Oh.
But don't you make the GRB if it still has the angular momentum?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
But there are physical reasons that could use an angle and they're not making a reduce. So there would be room for this. If you wanted to say this,
Paolo, if you go back to the slide, so what do you expect for the physics of additional mixing in the presence of quantum binaries compared to stars that are not in contact? Do you expect that to be enhanced?
Well, I would expect it to be enhanced in the sense that what you care is essentially the breaking from spherical symmetry. So this is what would drive large-scale currents, I think. So in here as well, you would have strong horizontal turbulence, essentially moving through constant pressure surfaces throughout both envelopes. So I would expect plenty of mixing to happen in the contact binary as well, and perhaps enhance it compared to the single star case.
Maybe like the tune-up of the FTC parameter that you take in single star population, the LC is probably not
I'm not even sure if it's right to take that from the LMC. But yeah, we could be underestimating mixing here, seeing it lightly, I think. But well, we already went a bit through this, so I don't think I need to talk too much. But the main thing is that in terms of this this exotic end stage of evolution, if you go up in initial masses of your stars, you will have them just going to the iron photodissociation region. You would have, in the simple picture, core collapse supernova. At some point, you form black holes. But at some point, you run into the perinstability region. You produce a perinstability supernova with no remnant. And if you go further up, you just go straight to a black hole, although it undergoes this explosive burning anyhow. And well, you have pulsational perinstability in the middle as well. And on top of these possibilities, you would have as well the possibility of long gamma ray bursts, which, if your angular momentum is high enough, could happen. So, well, what was I doing in terms of this is essentially modeling using a detailed 1D code, running large grids of models to explore the relevant parameter space. So the main idea is essentially for different mass ratios and metallicities, modifying the primary mass and the initial period and seeing what happens. So, well, we have two hard boundaries in a way, you could think. We have a boundary that the stars cannot be so close together from the main sequence, so this is a forbidden region. You have an upper envelope in here, which is regions where the orbital separation is too large, which makes the rotational velocity too slow, so you don't get the mixing you want. And in between, you get this window of possibility, this, I guess the colors mix up a bit, but it doesn't matter, of this light blue region, which is where you would form double black holes. The interesting part is that the hatching in here marks essentially systems that undergo through contact phases. So this is totally dominated by systems that go through contact, which means that you would have plenty of systems with mass ratio of 1 at the end. And the main way you have to see metallicity is that it essentially scales the wind strength. So at lower metallicities, you have less wind, which means more compact binaries and more massive ones. And this is essentially what you see if I check the final periods and the masses of my system. So the highest metallicity ones are usually at larger periods and smaller masses than the rest. And if you go low enough, you start reaching into the range where you get mergers in a Hubble time. And as well, you start pushing into the perinstability supernova regime and going above it. So, well, in terms of what things we would expect to observe, we have chair mass that would have this strong future. We would have a gap in chair masses. This edginess in here, you don't need to read it too literally. It's just because of the because we have a finite number of metallicities. And in terms of rates, we did some simple estimates for this, where we can talk about rates on this end and this end for advanced LIGO. And the main uncertainty is due to chemical evolution of the universe. Sort of. I mean, the way we computed this thing is very simplistic, and we're working on improving that. So as a reference, you could have what Selma and Ilya were doing. So Selma and Ilya did some proper rate computations with some working with a proper universe, you could say. And they got something of the sort with some ranges in between. I wouldn't trust too much that lower zero range. I think that's an overkilling the rate to the lower end. But anyhow, the main thing about this is that if you see this gap, then you have a clear sign that perinstability supernova happened. So mass ratios. So about mass ratios, the main thing I was saying, since you have so much contact happening, so if we see the final mass ratios compared to the initial ones, we get this accumulation of systems that go to mass ratio equal to 1. As we go to higher masses, at some point we break down from contact, we get systems that avoid it. But the thing is that since the mass loss rates are so strongly dependent on luminosity, the differences in mass loss drives the mass ratios, the final mass ratios, close to 1 anyhow. So at this very low high end, you would expect the mass ratios to be close to 1, even in the absence of contact. But over here, I think the interesting thing is that this is very well fine-tuned to one. As far as I know, advanced LIGO should be able to detect things in here. And well, you have to put this in contrast in the picture with the predictions from Selma and Ilya as well, because they have a range of mass ratios. And this is because in their model, which was a much more simple population synthesis model, their mixing was more efficient, so they could break down from just having contact systems. And they would get a widespread in here. But anyhow, you would expect to have all these contact systems, which would meet a, mean a pileup of systems at mass ratio of equal to 1, independent of the efficiency, you could say. So this picture, we have already seen it. This sort of mix up together several things that could happen. On the one hand, depending on your final angular momentum, perhaps you, you would form critically rotating black holes and possibly long gamma ray bursts. At some point, you are also forming peri-instability supernova, and if you're in the right mass range, you would be forming pulsational peri-instability supernova as well, which might be important to perhaps lower spins, like the question I was asking before. And in the end, when you go to the higher end masses, you go above this peri-instability supernova regime, and the black holes you would be expecting to see here would normally be of a much lower spin. So we wouldn't expect high spins on the high mass end unless you push it to very, very low metallicities. So, well, what happens at these lower metallicities? So a simple picture would be that, well, we have more compact stars, so we can put them closer together and we have more mixing. But it doesn't quite work that way because what we want is the star to be rotating fast compared to its critical velocity. We want some important amount of deformation due to rotation. And this is not just fixated by an absolute rotational velocity, like saying 200 kilometers per second or something. It depends on how compact the star is. So in reality, we have that the limit pushes down and down in terms of initial period. And also it becomes more it becomes smaller at the higher masses. And this is because, a bit counterintuitively, you have mass loss rates going down. And at the highest masses, mass loss helps you get to the helium-rich layers. So this reduces the parameter space in here, and it becomes more and more small. And the funny thing is that if you push this all the way to population 3, you have no parameter space at all. And this is because your stars need to be so compact that the merger timescale due to gravitational waves is mega years. So they merge during the main sequence, essentially. They don't get to the end of hydrogen burning. So, well, what happens? So this is all what the picture we get at mass ratios close to 1. But we have differences if we push this thing to lower mass ratios. So at intermediate mass ratios, so this is what the picture we had right now, at intermediate mass ratios, we would expect, well, one star might be evolving chemically homogeneous. The other one would not be rotating fast enough. So at some point, it will start growing, and you would have inverse mass transfer in a very compact binary that quite likely might end up in a merger. The thing is that if you push this further down, then you will have one star evolving chemically homogeneous. And since the other one is much less massive, it essentially does nothing until the other one forms a black hole. So this is essentially the same star until here you start having a much longer timescale for evolution. And this star will eventually fill its Rochlove and accrete material to a very massive black hole. And the main benefit of having a configuration like this is that it's very easy to explain very high luminosities, as observed in these ultra-luminous X-ray binaries that are hard to explain with single star-formed black holes. So, well, we've run some models for this. So I don't want to go into too much detail in this, but the main idea is that here you have a window here for chemically homogeneous evolution of the primary. You have a gap in here, that's the peri-instability supernova gap, and you would be forming ULXs from systems on this end and on this end. And if you push it high enough in mass ratio, then eventually you lose these systems and you just get either merging or going off chemically homogeneous evolution or or any other things that might be less, would be more pedestrian. So, well, in terms of explaining ULXs with this, you have to be a bit careful because we know plenty of information about X-ray luminosity functions. And in particular, we know that for these galaxies where we see plenty of ULXs, we know the luminosity functions extends all the way to the high mass X-ray binaries. So some people argue that this is just, so ULXs in a way would just be the extension of this luminosity function to this high luminosity. So this is the ULX luminosity range. And on the other hand, they have that this is very strongly related to star formation. So if they grab all these things and normalize them with star formation, they get a very nice set of concentrated lines. But the main picture here would be that if this chemically homogeneous evolution is forming ULXs, we would be forming the most extreme ULXs for any given population. So, well, we can play a bit on checking what kind of black holes we would be forming, what luminosities we would be having. And as I said, this is for relatively high metallicity. And we would be having relatively high luminosities and quite massive black holes from the get-go. So the interesting thing is that as we push down in metallicity, we would have this upper end mass for the black holes going up, just as we had for the gravitational waves. Eventually, it would be jumping across a mass gap, and it would keep going that well until too much lower metallicities. And at one point, we would just be seeing black holes in here. The interesting thing as well is that we can check the number of expected sources we would have. So a typical way to normalize this is in terms of the star formation rate. And we would see that we would have an increase in formation of objects as metallicity. We would have a peak at about 10 to the minus 4. And then it would start dropping. And by this low metallicity, we would see very little sources. So, well, one thing is that if we take this picture of all these processes that could happen and we try to draw, this is a schematic diagram of what would happen to a star that is close to its period for Roche-Love overflow, then what we would expect to see is that as we go high in mass, we get more effects of chemically homogeneous evolution. And depending on whether we're at the high mass ratio or low mass ratio regime, we would be getting double black holes or ULXs, and on both ends, we could be getting long gamma ray bursts. So this is sort of a rich possibility of options. It's not just merging double black holes, but we have many additional things that could happen in here as well. And another additional thing that could happen is, since we have this compact systems with a very massive black hole and a much less massive star, is that in the end, we could have this star forming a neutron star and producing a merging black hole neutron star system. The main issue with this is that if we had this system undergoing mass transfer before to form the ULX, it would be relatively wild. So for instance, we would have at the moment of explosion for one of these models, low metallicity model, we get a black hole of around 56 solar masses. So probably we need to work a bit more in peristability supernova when we talk about those masses. And you have a 12 solar mass helium core in the end, at a period of about 11 days. So this is too wide to merge. But the thing is that if we turn this into a neutron star and we add a kick to the system, then there is a fraction of systems, given these initial conditions, that would end up close enough to merge. So this is what I'm showing here is for this system, I simulate many, many possibilities for the kick. And I have this region of favorable kicks all the way down up there for which the merger times go below a Hubble time. And I can say that, well, the fraction of systems for which this would happen is low. So this is usually in the order of 5% for the systems. But perhaps I need to work it out and see if it would be actually astrophysically relevant. Another possibility as well is black hole. So you can, when you have you're forming your very massive black holes, you can also have as well very massive secondaries. And well, here I was just doing this is a toy model saying what would happen with a much smaller kick. So this is an order of magnitude smaller kicks than for the neutron stars I was showing before. and a bit of Maslow's as well. And the thing is that you get this tiny bit in here for which this could happen. But this is really a tiny fraction. So I think maybe the neutron star black hole could be relevant. I'm not sure if this will get to any decent rate in the end. And well, just in case, that's the case of a symmetric kick. So I mean symmetric supernova, so no kick. So just to finish, I wanted to briefly mention that when you have a contact system, it doesn't just make the masses equal, it also synchronizes the nuclear clocks of the stars. If one is more evolved than the other one, it will attempt to transfer mass back through this shared envelope. And in the end, if we have, so this is an example of two stars. They're in a very compact initial orbit, so they start mass transfer very early on. And the thing is that we get this nice spiral pattern in the HR diagram that eventually finishes with both stars becoming essentially the same. And the thing is that for these systems that evolve in timescales of mega years, we're getting differences in the final lifetimes that are of order 100 or 1,000 years to the most, it would seem. And the thing is that perhaps at some point this would result in, for all these possible transients that could come out of it, in sort of synchronized transients as well, but on timescales that might not be relevant for me, but decent enough, I would say. And well, that's it essentially.
Questions for Pablo? So the metallicities you're showing of sort of 10 to the minus differences between 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 4, and so on, is that just basically the wind or the nuclear reactions mattering? The reason I'm asking is because the very low metallicity halo stars, it's not all the elements that are reduced, right? Iron is very low, but the alpha elements saturate at 10 to the minus solar.
So the main future we would expect would be to be iron content more than anything. So this is really, it's almost all winds, you could say. So for winds, we care mostly about iron, because for this hot stars, we care about radiation-driven winds.
If you think silicon doesn't matter, silicon is sort of saturated at 10 to the minus 2 and a half solar, whereas iron is 10 to the minus 5, so it's surprising.
Could be an important factor. So, well, maybe we can ask the people working more on winds on how much silicon would affect at the lower iron content.
It's oxygen, magnesium,
yeah. So, well, I think once you drop iron, your winds would drop significantly anyhow. So even if there's a bottom line due to other elements, I think it would still be way, way, way less than what iron provides. Yes.
It affects you see the stellar structure more than the winds, right?
Hmm?
I think the effects you see by the winds is more the stellar structure.
Well, so in a way, this.
Do you use this M dockers like square to C?
We're using a scaling that's determined locally. That's one thing. But yeah, I mean, there's a structural effect as well, but in the sense that you get more compact orbits. But I would guess the stronger effect is the wind. That's the main effect that comes into play.
Do you see primary
nitrogen production in some of these things? I think not really. I don't go to very late burning stages for most of the models anyhow.
Especially in the rotating models, and especially at low metallicity, you often get interpenetration of the helium core and the hydrogen convective envelope. And so you end up making a lot of nitrogen, even in a star with very low metallicity. And that radically alters the nuclear energy generation rate.
Well, but these stars never develop a relevant convective envelope. So So
these are all chemically homogeneous.
Yes, products. All the ones that I work in here, whenever they stop being chemically homogeneous, I forget about them.
Okay.
So there's mixing of both composition and also angular momentum. Are both of these important? Is the only thing that really matters is how you model chemical mixing? Does the rotational mixing also affect the structure and whether you have efficient chemically homogeneous evolution or not?
Well, the thing is that both of those are coupled. So, I mean,
In reality, we don't know how they're coupled. So that's
question.
Well,
I mean, in reality, your strength for mixing elements will be related to your local angular momentum, which will be related to how you transport angular momentum through the star. So I think in reality, these two things are coupled. And, well, we also mold them in a coupled way. So we use strong coupling for angular momentum transport. We use this magnetic torque models. So usually these stars are very strongly coupled all the way to the late phases.
Just the little comment about your Lexus. I think it's very, very interesting what you presented. Just a couple of comments, because some of the your Lexus are confirmed neutron stars. So, and some of the your Lexus are confirmed, okay, confirmed, difficult, it's a strong word, but majority of people agree that there are something to do with disk properties and with supercritical accretion and all this physics which goes inside. So I don't dispute your model. I'm saying that it's perhaps not suitable to explain the whole population.
No. And that's the point I was making it here. So you have an extension of the high mass X-ray binaries that already pushes to very high luminosities. So from this population, we would already expect it to be seeing some of this. And as you say, we have, I don't know if it's just one case of the neutron star ULX, or we have an extra one?
One.
Yeah, the pulsar.
And then there are a couple of other suspiciously low masses.
Yeah. Yeah. But we also have some that have, that we know the accreting source is quite massive, so very likely a black hole. And they fall here on the lower end. But we have as well these hyperluminous X-ray sources. There are a handful, but they push all the luminosity all the way down to here or so. So for those, you would need very massive or even intermediate massive black holes. And this would be something in between the standard population and the one that people claim they might be intermediate mass black holes.
For the rate calculations, you must have assumed that some fraction of stars went through the chemically homogeneous evolution. What is this fraction?
We computed the fraction that's part of the. So in a way, we normalized this to the core collapse rate.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about essentially how many double black holes you would be forming per supernova, and we also make the distinction between above and below this peristability supernova gap.
So what fraction of black holes would be formed through this homogeneous evolution?
So these are the numbers you would want to have. So it's of a factor of 1 every 1,000 supernova would be going through this channel for low metallicities.
Okay.
So at once you push to higher metallicities, you get zero.
And just to be clear, this is some assumption about binaries are flat in log period and flat in log mass ratio.
Salpeter in the IMF, flat in log P, and other assumptions.
To continue these questions, does it mean that if you get the rates that are similar to the classical channel, that your homogeneous evolution channel is 1,000 times more effective in producing binary black holes?
So what are the rates from the classical channel?
Well, if we get the same result and you have here about 1,000 of black holes that are produced in this channel and the final result is the same, then the binary black hole production must be 1,000 times more effective. So I'm asking, you know, what fraction of stars goes through this homogeneous evolution? What fraction of mass of stars?
So, so that's essentially the fraction. That's normalized to the supernovae.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a factor of 2 or 3 because this is a binary, and if you care about all stars, it changes a bit. But that's the order of magnitude you would you want to
so
have in mind.
So you assume that basically all stars go through homogeneous.
No. This is made with the calculations, with the detailed models.
Okay,
so I just integrate the grids I have. I grab my probability distribution functions for whatever, and those are the numbers that pop out.
Okay, let's talk about it later. And the second thing is that when you consider this double, this binary with 260 solar mass stars, and you said that it's difficult to make to form something like that in the classical evolution scheme. What is this based on? Did you do any calculation, or is just a feeling? Or
well, it's because you need to fine tune the things. Well, also Chris was telling me you need to have sort of a shared common envelope, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So the fine tuning you need to do for that is extreme. And the other issue is that, come on, get up. That the stars are at a very late phase together, so they expand, they form giants, and they essentially start in spiraling in together, and they eject the full envelope of both stars. But what I want to show is as well that you have a possibly another binary in here. So putting
this other binary is probably required to make the first one eccentric in any scenario.
Yes, but the thing is that you want this guy to be relatively close anyhow. Mm-hmm. And if you want to put a common envelope in there, and these two stars undergoing the common envelope at the same time, then this is a bit restrictive.
Okay. I'll ask a question. So you said that you expect the core collapses to be fairly synchronized. I realize it's not necessarily in terms of human lifetimes, but I'm curious about that distribution because I think if these do make GRBs, I mean, it's a little bit crazy, but if they do make GRBs, they have to be a fair fraction of the GRBs. And so, I mean, I realize most of them, it's probably going to be a delay. I mean, I guess my question is, what is a typical delay, and what is that distribution of delays? Because, of course, we've observed, bats observe 2,000 GRBs over a decade.
So you mean this delay between both stars? You mean the delay between both stars?
Yeah, the delay between the two core collapses.
So it's usually, well, I would trust more the order of magnitude of what I have. I don't actually need to go all the way here. I would. And on one hand, I would trust more or less the order of magnitude of this because it's very hard to do these calculations for several mega years and get the final lifetime all the way to these numbers. So I sort of trust from doing the simulations that you should get numbers of this order. But I wouldn't go all the way to doing a delay distribution for the time it takes for it to finish.
It might be interesting to look at it because we do have, I mean, Stan's right. I mean, maybe the two, if they both make GRBs, they're not pointing towards this curve.
Yeah.
They are in the same binary.
I mean, they're synchronized.
Right. So you would expect.
So I think that unless there's a reason that they stop with a 100-year delay, they scattered to 1 or 10-year delays. Otherwise, I think they're right. Batsy probably rules it out.
Yeah, but even if you would have a kick or something due to the long gamma ray burst, then the spin of the other one should still be pointing in the same direction the other one was at the beginning. Perhaps this is as well interesting in the terms of peristability supernovae, because those would not be, you wouldn't expect them to be so directional. There's one candidate, right? Yeah, the GRBs are well constrained.
Okay, any more questions for Pablo?
High metallicity case, presumably most of them make binary black holes, but just ones that will merge in 100 Hubble times or something.
Yeah.
So if you do your sort of a population synthesis? What is the ratio of ones that don't merge in a Hubble time to ones that do? How many are left over out there?
I don't do the simulations due to technical reasons to the much higher metallicities. I mean, it becomes progressively harder to model more metal-rich stars. So I'm lucky that the range where I want this to work, to form merging double black holes, is computationally easy to do. But if I want to push it to these other systems, then I guess with a few years of work on getting that better, I could get those numbers out. But right now, I don't know.
OK, let's thank Pablo and Stan again. So we'll